clear. Oh, it comes off Hughes. A wee bit better. It is McHugh!
Hello and welcome to the MSC podcast. As the season winds down, we've given Buster the weekend off and myself and Jay will back over yesterday's disappointing 1-1 draw against Accies. We'll look forward to next weekend's game against Dundee and we'll see what else takes a fancy over the next three quarters of an hour or so. Jay, welcome along.
Cheers.
Well, we'll start with yesterday's game and... For the most part, I think it was a bit of a procession, wasn't it? A pretty tedious game, very much controlled by ourselves. We let Accies back into it with an individual error. They capitalised on that, and then in the end, possibly could have went on to win the game, actually. They finished by far longer of the two sides. I think we'll look back on it with a degree of disappointment, but I guess the bigger picture is it wasn't a significant game for ourselves. It was certainly for Accies. A point, not the worst result in the world.
No, I think that pretty much covers it. I think, you know, during the game and immediately after, a bit of disappointment is there because, you know, I think you're right. I think it was winding down, you know, the idea of winding down the season. I thought that was pretty evident. I know that the players and management kind of made quite a lot of noise, you know, after the split about the fact that, oh no, you know, we won't be down in tools. There's still a lot to play for. We can still go for seventh. But it did have that kind of training game feel about it. And, you know, I think the conditions probably didn't help. It was very warm. Even just little things like the fact that, you know, they had the awards night to come, you know, even that, you know, adds to the kind of end of season feel about it. So, and I suppose even the support, you know, it was a big Motherwell support, but even the fans were quite subdued. You know, Mitch at the game even said, you know, made a comment after we scored that he doesn't think he's ever, you know, celebrated a goal against Hamilton Accies less than he did that one. Because I think there was just that kind of subdued acceptance that we were kind of just closing in on the end of the season. And I think Accies kind of contributed to that as well. I was quite surprised. You know, I thought they were, you know, very, very poor, but they seem, you know, that keen to, I don't know, they just didn't look like a side that's battling relegation, even when they got the goal back to one each. And as you say, they could easily have went on and won the game. And, you know, you had Dougie Emery time wasting for a one each. It was really, I thought it was just a very strange game. And I thought it actually did feel like two teams who had nothing to play for rather than one. So that obviously doesn't help in terms of a spectacle. But I think, you know, the day after, you can kind of see the reasons why. And I suppose it's human nature. You can bang on all day about how, no, we're going to keep going into the very last day. But, you know, human nature sets in and, you know, you can perhaps subconsciously take your foot off the gas a wee bit. And I think that's certainly what we ended up doing.
In terms of personnel, we did make a couple of changes. Jake Hastie dropped to the bench. Curtis Main didn't even make the 18 for reasons unbeknown. It wasn't confirmed after the game either. Does that indicate that there is guys that are in the squad? I noticed quite a lot of stuff in social media that guys had down tools. I don't think that was the case yesterday. You've obviously got guys playing for the futures. You've got guys that have clearly, behind the scenes, clarified that they're not going to be at the club next season. Does that change the dynamic of the game somewhat?
Well, I think it changes it in that, you know, the management team need to start thinking about next season. There's no point in, you know, as much as we've all kind of really enjoyed watching that kind of that 11 that has became, you know, cemented as our top 11, pretty much the team that started yesterday, but with Hastie and for Freer and Main and for Scott. But, you know, once you get to this part of the season, it's not Stephen Robinson's job just to, you know, make Motherwell fans happy at 2 o'clock in the afternoon when they check the lineup. It's his job to have one eye on the summer, the recruitment, you know, the fact that we've already, you know, got two players on pre-contract shows that we're not resting on our laurels. We're getting right in about it. We're getting, you know, the recruitment has begun. So you need to start looking at next season. You know, is James Scott ready for the, you know, to be a contender for that striker role, or is he going out on loan? You know, is Elliot Freer going to be able to do what Jake Hastie's been doing this year in terms of playing on the right-hand side and cutting in, because that obviously is a big, big part of how we've been playing recently. So, you know, you need to use these games for that. And I suppose that kind of adds to the idea that it is an end-of-season game. You know, we can have a go at the players for downing tools and things like that. But, you know, these games are, there is a friendly element to these games now, because that's what you use them for. You start to maybe try different things or see who is going to be able to play in certain positions, who is worth maybe, you know, if Elliot Freer, for example, I'm obviously not too clued up on, you know, contract negotiations and things with Elliot Freer, but if Elliot Freer, you know, really plays well between now and the end of the season, do you then knock up your offer a wee bit to him? It's just little things like that. So that obviously adds to the end of season feel of the game. But it's an important part of it, because I think the last thing you really want to be doing, as great as it would be to see our strongest 11 going out and beating teams between now and the end of the season, if you then get to the summer and you're playing a wee bit of catch-up because, you know, you don't know who's going to be here or who's going to be able to play in that system, you know, you don't want to get caught out in that situation. So I think we're doing the right thing, although it would obviously, you know, have been preferable if we'd, you know, managed to kind of tick both boxes, you know, use the game to try things and give the likes of Freer and Scott a start and also go in and win the game, which unfortunately we didn't.
You mentioned James Scott there. For me, someone that has kind of struggled to make the step up to the first team, and we've only seen him in sporadic appearances, so it's hard to make a complete judgment call. I wasn't absolutely convinced of him at reserve level either, to be honest, in the Iron Brew Cup games that I've seen this season, and albeit I have seen three Iron Brew Cup games, so it's not really the best basis to make a judgment call on him. It looks for all the world that he will get the last five games of the season to make an impact and to prove his worth. We've talked before in the podcast that he hasn't scored a goal yet for the first team. That is something that I think can hang over you and make your job somewhat more difficult. I thought he struggled with the physicality of the game yesterday. Quite often pushed out wide, playing the lone striker role. It was difficult against a physical Aki's side, but I think he's got a wee bit of a way to go, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he is still very young, and I think, you know, with what we saw with Jake Hastie in particular, it does seem to be a big part of our new kind of approach, you know, our step-by-step approach to youth development, to get guys out on loan and then bring them back once they've kind of... Because that's partly why you send guys to the lower leagues. It is that physicality element, you know, they come back. You know, it's that kind of old cliche, you know, they go out as boys and come back as men, because it's obviously a lot tougher, a lot more physical in the lower leagues. And that, I think maybe we're seeing at the moment that's perhaps the last stage of James Scott's development that's needed before he's going to really cement a place in the starting lineup. I don't think you can kind of underestimate just how difficult being a lone striker, you know, is. It's not just a case of running about and winning headers. You know, you need a lot of experience. You need to be able to read the game very, very well, because it's not just your job to be on the end of crosses, it's your job to hold the ball up, it's your job to bring midfielders and wingers into play. So you need to be able to read the game, and you need to have a good level of experience, and that's obviously something he doesn't have. And I think the game yesterday didn't really suit him, I don't think, because I don't know whether it's because the players, I don't know, perhaps aren't used to playing with him or what it was, but we did seem to be firing a lot more long balls at him than perhaps we have been doing so far this season. I don't know whether it's just because, you know, we had a fair amount of possession in the first half and didn't do a great deal with it and maybe ran out of ideas, but it kind of felt that we were just, you know, launching the ball at him quite a lot, and I don't think that really suited him. I think he seems, you know, although he is a big guy, I think he does look as though he'd maybe be a wee bit better with the ball at his feet, and yet we kind of took to just launching the ball at him, so I don't think the actual game suited him either. But he's obviously a player with a lot of potential. And I think, you know, there's no harm in giving him these games. And I think you're completely right. It doesn't matter who you are. You look at somebody like, you know, Higdon or you know, Lukas Jukovic when he came in. I remember Jukovic when he came in was, you know, getting pelters. He was, you know, a terrible signing. He couldn't get a goal. And then one goes in and suddenly turns into a goal machine. So I think that's a big, big part. If James Scott can get a good amount of experience between now and the end of the season and hopefully get a goal before the summer, and then you can kind of reevaluate at that point. I think a loan, you know, a loan would suit him. I think sending him out to even, you know, send him out to Alloa, you know, because it works so well with Jake Hasty. I think that would be a big, Jim big Goodwin part of his Alloa. Development. What's that?
Jim Goodwin's Alloa.
Aye, that's it, that's it. Particularly if they manage to stay up, it'd be a good move for him. I think he does need that. I think he needs a bit of a, you know, maybe 6 months in the lower leagues just to toughen him up and to get used to first team football. But it's obviously a good position to be in. You know, we're banging on all the time at the moment about young Motherwell, so it's a good position to be getting into a game like yesterday and having a young, you know, the next one off the conveyor belt starting.
Yeah, I kind of thought when Stephen Robinson's pre-match, he was talking about 7 academy players, and I kind of got the impression that we were going to play a very, very young team. We obviously have, but it's testimony to the quality of the guys and the young players in particular that they've bedded in, and they're now like it's kind of almost irrelevant that they're academy players and academy graduates, because they're such a pivotal part of our first team that we don't really regard them as academy graduates, do we? We possibly consider them as our best players.
Well, that's it. I mean, you look at you know, Chris Cadden comes on, and it's more like, you know, the returning stalwart, if you like. You know, he's coming back from injury, and you know, you almost have to stop and go, oh, wait a minute, he's still 22 and he's an academy graduate. You know, it just seems as though he's been about for so long now, and he's such an integral part of the team. Davy Turnbull, obviously winning just about every award going at the, you know, the Player of the Year awards. You know, another guy who you can't even, you know, it's difficult to actually fathom or remember, you know, the Motherwell side before Davy Turnbull was in it, because he's such an integral part of it. So you're right, I think it's not just, you know, it's one thing to, you know, pepper the squad with young players, but it's another to have young players who have the qualities that they, you know, aren't, you know, they are, you know, the most integral players in the team. You know, Campbell, you know, another one. These are guys that you almost have to remind yourself that they are still youngsters, because they, you know, by and large are the first names in the team sheet these days.
Yeah, absolutely. And we look ahead to next season already. Stephen Robinson, since the last time we recorded, actually has strengthened the side with 2 new signings. Declan Gallagher will arrive from Livingston, while Liam Polworth will join from Inverness Caledonian Thistle. 2 guys that have established themselves in Scottish football. Jay Gallagher's enjoyed a great season. And of course, there is a bit of baggage for me. His personal life and stuff that has been well documented, which makes absolutely fuck all difference, to be perfectly honest, in the grand scheme of things, when it comes to the fact that he's been given a second chance. It's one he's grasped with both hands, and enjoyed a fantastic season with Livingston this year after helping them to promotion last season. Liam Polworth, a guy that has caught attention playing against Motherwell in previous years, this season he's enjoyed a very productive year as well, contributing a vast number of assists, for Inverness. 2 guys that look like they'll certainly bolster our squad. And it's interesting as well that we seem to have changed our signing tact from looking at the lower leagues in England to actually looking closer to home.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, Declan Gallagher, I think, is a good signing. I know it's very easy to kind of watch sort of Livingston highlights and, you know, see him as this big guy, because I've seen a lot of comments on social media and forums about, you know, oh, that's us going back to being hammer throwers and things like that. But Declan Gallagher's a very, very good football player. You know, actually, I know it's not, you know, a great testament to footballing abilities, but I did play fives with him a good few years ago, a couple of times, and he's a phenomenal football player. I know he plays at the right back at times for Livingston as well, when they play with a back four, you know, predominantly because he can play football as well as being this big, powerful centre half. So the idea that, you know, we've signed a hammer thrower is, you know, quite far from the truth. And I think he'll fit in well. I think he's a guy who, you know, we're all talking about how well Tom Aldred has done this season and how unlikely it is he's going to be at the club next year. I think Declan Gallagher's a great replacement, because I think he has had such a fantastic season. And I think you're right, the baggage that goes with him, you know, I think we could discuss that all day. And, you know, I know a lot of people kind of spit the dummy over these kind of things, but you know, you have to have a situation in all walks of life, whether it's football or not. You know, if someone does something wrong and is punished for it and serves their time, then at some point, you know, they need to be allowed to return to their trade, essentially. And you're right. I mean, he's 28 years old. I think his career has suffered because of that. You know, I think we talk about football not having morals and things like that, and footballers can do things and then walk straight back into their job. But you're talking about a guy who's, you know, not just walked straight into, you know, the top flight. He's had to kind of build his career from scratch, if you like, again. You know, he was already lower leagues when it happened, and then suddenly he's you know, missed a couple of years because of that. So I think that you actually have to tip your hat off to him for getting back in there, and actually now at 28 years of age, moving to an established top flight club. I don't think there's any doubt that we're a bigger club than Livingston, so I think it's a good signing for us, and I expect him to do really well. And the Polworth one, I've not seen a lot about Polworth, but everything seems to kind of suggest that he is that kind of creative player that they can chip in with assists, and that's maybe something we've lacked. David Turnbull's obviously been fantastic, but I think in terms of creating chances for you know, Curtis Main or James Scott, whoever's going to be leading the lines, that's something we've maybe failed a little bit. We've been relying on Turnbull for goals and Hasty to chip in from the wings. So I think someone that can obviously create a wee bit more for the striker is going to be welcomed. And I think you're right. I think it's something that a lot of fans have kind of been sort of clambering for over the years, this idea that there's good players in Scotland that we could be going after. And the argument's always been that it's quite difficult because, of course, there's added, inflated fees between Scottish clubs and things like that. I think maybe the club have got it right in the past. I was one that subscribed to that idea. I used to kind of get in my high horse about how annoying it was. We were going and bringing in people I'd never heard of in the English non-leagues, and guys like, for example, you know, Sybold and Alston at Falkirk looked as though they could do a job. And you look at them now and, yeah, they're in the top flight, but are they really, you know, setting the header alight? Not really. So maybe the club, you know, have done well over the years. But I think it's something we need to be moving towards, because that market that we've done so well in, that kind of lower league English market that we've done so well in, that is becoming more and more difficult to really make a success of that. The money down there is ever increasing. So, you know, you even just look at somebody like Tom Aldred. The main reason we're not probably going to be able to hold on to him is because he can just walk down to, you know, a team in League Two in England, or even in the non-leagues, and possibly get, you know, double what he would get at Fir Park. So you're competing with the teams down there, but you're also competing with, you know, bigger teams in Scotland now who are starting to, I think we've kind of set the trend there, but, you know, teams like Hibs and Hearts and Aberdeen are all starting to kind of look at that market because they've seen the success we've had with guys like Marvin Johnson and Louis Moult. So it's paramount for us to keep, you know, being able to put out a good quality side, that we're going to have to be looking at, you know, different markets and keeping our options open. And I think it's two very, very good signings. And when you look that, you know, both players were wanted by other clubs in the Scottish top flight, I think it says a lot for, you know, the direction the club is going. That they wanted to come to Motherwell. So that's obviously a bonus as well.
I guess another significant factor in this is actually doing your business early. I feel that I was speaking to Grant Russell during the week, and he was saying that I think it's the 12th of June the players are back at pre-season training, so that I think they get 3 weeks off. It's not a significant amount of time, obviously, but we'll have a squad in place rather than the pre-season almost being interrupted by new signings and new arrivals. It looks like we're going to try and actually have that core of a squad in place for returning for pre-season, and then we can push on from there. And I think that's maybe something that's quite significant. We were buying players almost up to the last minute during last summer, and we all saw how poor we were at the start of last season, or this season, sorry. Having that structure in place, there's obviously a lot of good work goes on with Martin Foyle, Keith Lasley and Stephen Robinson, and getting the right players in. Doing it early is a boost, certainly, and it will allow these guys to integrate into the squad and hopefully have us ready to go come the Betfred games and then the start of the Premiership season.
Well, that's I think there's again, it's two signings. Some people will be, you know, overjoyed with them. Some people will be, you know, raising eyebrows and things like that. That's the nature of football. But I think there's a lot to be positive in terms of how we appear to be doing our business. You look at last summer, and even listened to the podcast maybe in the first half of this season when we were just absolutely powering the transfer approach last summer, this 12 to 18 idea, and how kind of, you know, we largely failed. I think it was largely a failure. And of course, as the summer approaches, you would love guys like Gordon to perhaps stay. You know, obviously mentioned Aldred. So there is going to be guys leaving, and that will be difficult to replace. But it's very important that we do it early. Obviously, I imagine we are aware that it's very unlikely that Tom Aldred is going to be here next year. We are no doubt, you know, I don't know what the situation actually is with Peter Hartley, but are we expected to see him next year? Liam Donnelly, somebody who's not really came in and made a success of it. So, you know, I think that we've obviously identified positions very, very early, and there's no reason to kind of hang about to the summer. As we were saying earlier, you've got these games to even, you know, try things and to see what positions you're going to have to strengthen. So if you're going to be preparing for next season in terms of offering contracts, in terms of giving James Scott a couple of games, then you absolutely should be preparing for next season in terms of signings. And if you can get guys in on pre-contracts, so everybody knows, you know, you can tick that box, right, we've got a centre-half coming in. It allows you to then, you know, expend a little bit more energy or resources, maybe targeting other areas of the team. So I think it's a positive thing, because the last thing you want to do is to kind of hold off doing your business, just wait and see what the guys out of contract are going to do and see how the end of season turns out, and then, you know, get caught cold and get beaten to targets. And next thing you know, you're into August and you're clambering about trying to fill gaps in your team.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that brings us on quite nicely to potential outgoings. And I mentioned earlier on in the podcast that Curtis Main wasn't in the 18 yesterday. Jake Hasty dropped to the bench. We'll start with Hasty in particular. It looks for all the world that we have given up the fight to secure his future. It looks like he has decided, whether he has had advice from elsewhere, that his future lies elsewhere. The talk in the press, and I think Alan Burrow's dealt with it very well, and the reasons for not having him signed on an extended contract. Now, this is actually a question that we got on Twitter rather than me planning the podcast very well, because I've got absolutely nothing in front of me at this moment in time. But the talk was the 400 grand development fee, and the fact that if we had actually secured his future to a longer term, it was very unlikely that we would have got any more money. Now, I don't know whether that's a wee bit of a kind of summary of Jake Hasty and perhaps the fact that he's not going to kick on the way that many are predicting he will, or the fact that whether he was in a contract or not, he would be leaving the club this summer. We've talked in the past about players leaving for reduced fees, the likes of Jamie Murphy and Mark Reynolds. In recent times, we've held out for bigger fees, but these were for guys like Cedric Kiepre, like Louis Moult, that went down south and obviously weren't on a development contract like the likes of David Turnbull and Jake Hasty will be. What's your take on it? For me, Jake Hasty broke onto the scene, did fantastically well. It took us all by surprise, definitely, because he had only scored one goal at Alloa. We knew that he was doing well, but we didn't expect him to perform on the scale that he has done since breaking into the first team. And then since the speculation, I think his form has dipped. I don't think it's fallen off a cliff in any way. As a young player, you will be inconsistent, but he's certainly not hit the heights that he did when he broke through in the first couple of weeks. I'm thinking his goal at St Mirren, his fantastic goal against Livingston. I think the speculation has got to him somewhat.
I mean, it's one of those ones that you can speculate. I mean, it's either that he is this fantastic player who, for whatever reason, you know, didn't do it at Alloa, who has seen his form dip because of the speculation, or he's a decent enough player who just had a purple patch when he first, you know, just, you know, the planets aligned and he just had this fantastic run in the Motherwell team. You know, I can't obviously comment on that. I don't see him every day in training. I didn't actually see him at Alloa. I'm sure those at the club, you know, the guys involved in the academy and Alan Burrows and the management team will have a greater grasp on that. You know, but you're right that either way, since his name was all over the papers. There has been either, you know, as I say, a dip or an end to the purple patch. I think teams like Hibs, Rangers, you know how to play him. They've worked out very quickly how to kind of manage him, doubling up on him and things like that. And he has, you know, I'm not going to say disappeared, but he hasn't really contributed much in the last few games. So it will be interesting to see what happens there. In terms of, you know, a take on the way we approach young players' contracts, it's a difficult one because I can kind of see both sides. I think the problem the club have is that nowadays with social media and things like that, you pretty much track a player's career from, you know, 15, 16 these days. I mean, we're all aware of Jamie Semple, who was obviously on the bench yesterday. I think we've all been aware of Jamie Semple for a good couple of years now. And we're all expecting and waiting for Jamie Semple to eventually make that breakthrough into the first team. And if you then find yourself in a situation where Jamie Semple's then in a position to go and, you know, sign for Rangers or Celtic or whoever else because you don't have him in a longer-term deal, I think that's where the backlash comes. It's not like, you know, the old days when I first started going to Motherwell games. You know, yes, you would know names of young players, and if you went to the reserve games, you'd maybe know who they are. But by and large, you know, a young player would just pop up on the bench one day, maybe start getting some appearances, and then find themselves in the team. And then you would get to know the player, whereas that's completely changed now. So you spend, if you're on social media, you know who all these guys are, and you know who the special ones are. So we've all been aware of David Turnbull, of Alan Campbell, and of Jake Hasty for a good couple of years now. So when you find yourself in a situation when both David Turnbull and Jake Hasty could have been signing pre-contracts elsewhere, that is going to raise eyebrows, that is going to annoy people. People are going to ask why that's the situation. So I can see both sides. I don't really know what the answer is. But I think, you know, I think regardless, I think there will be lessons to be learned because, you know, we go every week raving about David Turnbull. He, you know, as I said earlier, won practically every award at the Player of the Year. And yet, let's not forget that he could be, you know, in the exact same position as Jake Hasty at the moment. We could be winding down to the end of the season, expecting that we're seeing the last four times that David Turnbull will turn out in a Motherwell jersey. So I think there surely can be improvements to be made at some level. I understand the club's take on it. And, you know, I'm not a numbers man. You know, I don't work for the Youth Academy, so perhaps I'm misguided on it. But I think, you know, when you have, I don't think MD's suggesting that we dish out long-term deals to every Motherwell youngster. But I think we are, particularly nowadays, every Motherwell fan is aware of who the real potential stars are, the players that are really going to make a mark or are expected to make a mark. And I think if those guys, you know, come into your team and perform as expected, or in Jake Hasty's you know, case actually outperform the expectations, then I do think it is going to raise eyebrows when, you know, those players are in that position. So I don't know what the answer is, but I think there needs to be maybe a wee re-evaluation in how we approach that. Because as I say, social media in particular plays a big, big part because everybody is now aware of these guys. Jake Hasty isn't a guy who, you know, we were familiar with the name, but didn't really know much about him. And then he's just exploded onto the scene. Any Motherwell fan with Twitter and Facebook and things like that will know that Jake Hasty has been one of a small group of players for a good few years who was expected to go on and play in the first team. And I think that's where people start to kind of raise eyebrows. But again, I don't know what the answer is because, you know, we're in a situation where the best, what I would suggest is the best players of that kind of generation, the likes of Campbell and Turnbull, we do have on contracts. So I suppose that with that, you know, in that regard, we're perhaps doing it properly.
In terms of David Turnbull, that's another question that we got in the Twitter when I explained that I didn't have any notes in front of me today. Where do you lie with that one? David Turnbull obviously signed to an extended contract, but it's hard to argue that his stock value has ever been higher. The fact that he absolutely cleaned up at the Player of the Year awards. And to be perfectly honest, I actually agree with the club's one more than I agree with the outcome of our Player of the Year. For me, David Turnbull is our Player of the Year and our Young Player of the Year this season. Mm-hmm. He's been that good. There was times yesterday as well where he just looked a class above everyone on the park. He will be on the radar of certain clubs, particularly down south, where they can afford to splash the cash. If you get a bid in for David Turnbull, will that attract the attention of the powers that be at Motherwell this season?
I mean, it's a difficult one. I mean, again, he's different class, and he's only going to get better. I think he's genuinely one of the, if not the most technically gifted young player I've ever seen at Motherwell. I think he just has, it's that kind of thing that you can't teach. Yes, he has the ability, he has the touch, but it's the vision and the composure and the ability to take sort of a split second more time on the ball than every other player on the park, just to allow play to develop that slightly bit further and then pick the right pass. I think it was Robinson himself who described Turnbull as, you know, a continental type player, and I think that's absolutely spot on. And for me, when David Turnbull leaves, he should absolutely leave as our, you know, our biggest sale of all time. You know, it's difficult, obviously, in the modern era. We're a fan-owned club, so of course you can't be turning up your nose at pretty much any transfer offer. You need to obviously consider it properly. But for me, David Turnbull is a step above any young player. And, you know, as a Motherwell and Scotland fan who, you know, was obviously going when the likes of McFadden and Pearson and Hamill were breaking into the side, I fully expect David Turnbull, I would hope that David Turnbull goes for more than James McFadden did, at least. I think David Turnbull is actually a better player. I know that that'll probably that's probably a controversial statement, but where James McFadden had the, you know, the gallusness and was able to take players on and go past players, and was obviously a good finisher, I think David Turnbull does things on a football pitch that are really truly special. It's not about, you know, 20 step overs and then pinging it in the top corner. It's his ability to read the game, his ability, you know, I saw someone on, I think it was in Pye and Bovril, kind of described it as, it's a little bit like the Matrix. It's as though he has the ability to kind of just stop play, you know, stop everybody else, have a wee look around, decide what he's going to do, and then do it. I genuinely can't talk highly enough about David Turnbull. So if an offer does come in the summer, I would like to think that the club would be looking for, you know, 2 million plus, because we have seen players, you know, you've got Aberdeen talking, you know, nonsense money for the likes of, you know, Scott McKenna. You had Dundee selling Jack Hendry, who's genuinely one of the worst centre-halves I've ever seen in a Scotland jersey, you know, selling them at 1.5 million to Celtic. If teams like that are asking for money like that for players, you know, as mediocre and as average as that, then we should absolutely be sticking a big, you know, price tag on David Turnbull. As you say, he's signed a new deal, so there's no rush. We don't need to be too concerned about, you know, losing him for this or losing him for that. Obviously, you don't want to get to a situation where he leaves at the end of a contract and we do end up only, you know, 300, 400 grand for a player who should be generating more. But I genuinely I can't speak highly enough about David Turnbull. And when he does leave, whether it is to be this summer, the January transfer window next year, whenever it is, you know, obviously injuries permitting and things like that, if things continue to go the way they're going, then he should absolutely be, you know, going in our record books as the biggest transfer fee that we've received.
There we go. David Turnbull better than James McFadden.
What's your take on that?
I'm glad that that hasn't been committed to spoken record there, what you just said. I reckon that these awards are just the first step on his way to the Ballon d'Or, to be perfectly honest.
Well, the James McFadden point is more the fact that James McFadden is a flamboyant player. You know, he's exactly the kind of player that gets the attention, gets the headlines, and can be a match winner. So, you know, I'm comparing, you know, apples and oranges there, in fact, in terms of ability, because they are two completely different players. And David Turnbull perhaps won't have the overall career that James McFadden did in terms of, you know, being an international match winner, scoring in the Parc de France, all that kind of stuff. But for me, David Turnbull has all the attributes to end up playing. You know, why David Turnbull has shown enough for me that I genuinely would not be surprised that, you know, 23, 24, if he's playing in the midfield for, you know, a top-end Premiership club and is playing for, you know, a bigger side down south than James McFadden managed. I know that, you know, there's a lot of love for Faddy, and myself included, a great, great player. But I genuinely think that in terms of, you know, being technically gifted and reading the game and composure, I mean, David Turnbull is unlike the vast 99.9% of Scottish players that we bring through. You know, it goes back to that kind of idea that Robinson said about continental players. 99.9% of players that we bring through, whether it is, you know, guys like Andy Robertson, guys like Ryan Fraser, you know, guys who are reaching the kind of the pinnacle of club football at the moment, you know, I still don't think that they've got that kind of, it's almost, you know, an alien ability to kind of read the game and slow down the game. And, you know, I think that the absolute sky's the limit for David Turnbull. We spend so long kind of thinking, aye, but he's Scottish, you know, so, you know, he possibly can't go all the way, you know, he's maybe not as good as we think he is, because I think that's just a kind of a natural reaction in Scotland and in Scottish football. But you've got guys like Ryan Fraser, apparently linked with the likes of Arsenal. You've got Andy Robertson, you know, probably a contender for player of the year at Liverpool. We do have the ability to produce very, very special players. And for me, if things keep going the way they're going, David Turnbull will be up there.
Yeah, he's absolutely off the charts when it comes to talent. I saw references to Phil O'Donnell and James McFadden winning the Young Player of the Year award. That's, in Motherwell terms, absolutely the pinnacle, isn't it, in terms of company and names to be put up aside. And to be fair, I thought he spoke really, really maturely when he was mentioned alongside both guys. He obviously hadn't seen Phil O'Donnell play for Motherwell, given that he actually grew up watching from the stands. He mentioned that he's only really seen James McFadden in YouTube videos and in highlights, but knew how big a figure he was in the club's history. And of course, he's absolutely right up there. If it wasn't for extenuating factors, James McFadden would possibly have a lounge or a stand named after him at Fir Park, because he was that significant in Motherwell's history. He's a godlike figure in Fir Park history. So for him to even be mentioned up alongside these guys is an incredible testimony to the impact he's made. And I think it's all merited. There was points yesterday where I just thought, you are miles better than anybody on this park. And I think his frustration after the game and his post-match interview was very, very telling, because he just looked like he was scunnered. We got sloppy in the second half of the game yesterday and we dropped well below David Turnbull's level. And obviously, that must get frustrating when you're that far and away the best player on the park. You will get frustrated, but I think he's still got his head firmly screwed on, and he knows that his opportunity will come and his time will come. Barring an injury or anything like that, David Turnbull is only going to get better, and that is a very, very exciting prospect for a Motherwell supporter.
Well, that's it. I mean, he's only going to get better in a Motherwell side, but he's also the type of player that if you were then to, you know, if he then gets that move, if you put him in a team surrounded by, you know, higher quality players, then he will get even better. He's that type of player. And I think that's, you know, perhaps, you know, in line with what I'm saying about the James McFadden thing. James McFadden had that, you know, that raw ability in terms of, you know, taking players on and step overs and all that kind of stuff. And you could put him in any team and he'll go and take players on. I think where David Turnbull's different is that there will be, you know, spells, like you said yourself yesterday, where it will be get frustrating because he isn't just on a completely different level. So he will get to a point where there is literally no point in him being at Motherwell anymore, because he'll just be doing things that nobody else is reading. And I think if you then take him for the Motherwell side and put him surrounded by players who are on the same level and the same wavelength, he will then, you know, continue to get better. And again, you know, going back to the idea of always, you know, I think there is that kind of Scottish mentality that you kind of hold back or are pessimistic or kind of go, well, you know, he's still young, you know, maybe he's not as good as we're saying. But you look at some of the young players that have, you know, broke through in recent years, obviously mentioned Robertson and Fraser, but even guys like, you know, John McGinn, you know, comes through at Hibs, by all accounts is doing phenomenally well down at Villa. Even, you know, the likes of Stuart Armstrong goes to Celtic as a standout in that Celtic side, then goes down to Southampton. You know, is David Turnbull really a million miles away for guys like that? I don't think he is. I think David Turnbull, if David Turnbull was to wake up tomorrow as a Celtic player, I think he would absolutely run the show in the Celtic midfield. And yet, you know, there are many players who have done the same sort of thing and then went on to prove that they are, you know, top, top class players. So, you know, again, I think we need to obviously keep the guys. I don't think there's any issues. I think he's got the right mentality. I think he's very switched on. So in terms of keeping his feet in the ground, I think, you know, it maybe won't take as much an effort with someone like that than perhaps, you know, if you're correct and Jake Hastie has allowed the speculation to go to his head, maybe he's the kind of guy who doesn't have the mentality to maybe reach a high level. But I think David Turnbull absolutely does. And hopefully I'll need to bookmark this podcast, because when David Turnbull has entered the Scotland Hall of Fame and is regarded as one of the best players in the world, I can listen back and say, I said that he was going to turn out better than James McFadden.
Well, there we go. It's a bold prediction, but it's committed to spoken words, so you can't take it back now. Next week, Dundee visit Fir Park for a game of incredible magnitude for Dundee. My God, they're in a terrible run just now, and it looks for all the world that they will be relegated to the Championship. We obviously have a very good record against Dundee. They're the kind of opposition that we like to play anytime we're needing a victory. We go to Dens Park and we basically own the place. The circumstances, though, they'll take a very healthy support, not because the fans are desperate to see them play, but they're desperate to see them survive. And we're going to need to pick ourselves up, because we were sloppy in the second half against Accies yesterday. We can't stoop to these levels, because if we do and we're playing a team that are hungrier than us, we're going to lose the game. It's as simple as that. Though on our day, if we put in a performance, we relax a little and just play to the levels we know we can, we should be sweeping Dundee aside.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, I thought that, as we said earlier, the game yesterday was quite sloppy. It was kind of that training day feel to it. So if that is going to be the same between now and the end of the season, then, you know, we are going to struggle, because, you know, a team like Dundee, it is really do or die for them. I mean, I know that they can't, I don't think we can mathematically relegate them, but if, you know, I don't know who St Mirren and Accies are playing. I mean, they might even be playing each other for all I know. But, you know, if we beat Dundee and say St Mirren were to win, then they're then 9 points clear, you know, with a better goal difference. So that would all but relegate Dundee. So they are fighting for their lives. It really is the last chance. And if we're not that bothered, then it will be, you know, it will be a poor spectacle. And it is a game that we will possibly go on and lose. And it's interesting, because I saw a couple of debates on Twitter when we were still in with an outside chance of getting to the top six. And there was the odd point being made by, you know, obviously, admittedly, they're a minority, but there was this kind of argument being made that maybe being in the bottom six is better, because then at least you get to see your team win the last few games rather than losing to all the top six teams. Now, that's an absolute nonsense argument. You want to finish as high up the table as you can. If that means being in the top six, then great. But, you know, it's slightly ironic that we're now, after yesterday's performance, we're now sitting here talking about how, despite being in the bottom six, we might struggle to pick up points, because we're, you know, we haven't really shown enough yesterday to suggest that we're really up for the fight in these last four games. Maybe we are winding down. It's holiday mode. Maybe the guys who are out of contract are thinking elsewhere. Even just, you know, that kind of natural thing where if you are going to be out of contract in the summer and you don't know where you're going to be going for a medical, are you going to go in for that 50-50? Are you going to, you know, stretch yourself? Are you going to put as much effort in, because you might have to sit a medical down south, you know, in a few weeks' time? So I think we need to try and get past yesterday, rule out some of the silly mistakes that we've made over the last two games. You look at the mistakes, we practically handed Rangers every goal that they got against us, handed Accies that goal yesterday. So I think we need to be a wee bit more switched on. I think we need to realise that, yes, we don't have a great deal to play for, but we should still be aiming to try and finish seventh. And we should still be trying to, you know, reward the fans, if you like. Yes, there was a bit of bad blood for Robinson and the players in the first half of the season, but the fans have stuck by the team. There was a big support there yesterday, all paying, you know, £22 to get in. And I think there should still be a level of a performance to at least give the fans something to cheer between now and the end of the season. And then when you factor in the fact that we have made Fir Park a bit of a fortress, I think, you know, I think we're joint top with Celtic in terms of home form. I think they've played, I saw it on the BBC site earlier this year, I think they've played something like two games more at home or something like that. So they actually have won more points at home, but it's partly because they've played more there than we have. So we have this kind of fortress idea at Fir Park. So that should be another incentive, you know, go and don't don't relinquish that. Go in and make sure that you're continuing that to the end of the season, so that when you come back after the pre-season, you can look back and say, right, we've not been beaten, you know, at home, or we've not, you know, in many weeks, and we've got this great home record. There's no point in just letting that go, because you can't really be arsed in the last few weeks of the season.
Yeah, absolutely. And just a final one on the Dundee game. Do you think that you look back at the Rangers game, you look back at yesterday's game and the goals we've conceded, do you think our focus has somewhat waned in the last couple of weeks? Because we've lost four goals in these two games, and I think there's a case to argue that every one of those goals has been our own doing.
No, they absolutely are. And it's not just, I think, you know, it's been really, really poor, because, you know, you can get that goal where someone just maybe a lapse in concentration and they don't pick up a marker, or, you know, things like that. But it's been like really poor decision making, you know, for all four goals, or just not being aware of your surroundings. So that's something we need to stamp out, because you don't want to make it a habit. You don't want to get in. We are a young team, so you don't want to get into the situation where players are starting to get a wee bit nervous, you know, when they've got the ball in and around their own box, because we're starting to make a habit of mistakes. So that's why you need to eradicate that. Players make mistakes. I saw Robinson, you know, commenting after the game and saying, you know, we'll forgive Grimshaw because he's been outstanding this season, and that's completely correct. But you need to kind of stamp it out, because you don't want to get into a habit where, you know, whether it's Dunn, Grimshaw, Tate, Aldred, or one of the midfielders coming back to collect the ball for Gillespie, you don't want to start panicking and launching the ball and getting back into that long ball kind of rhythm, because you don't want to have the ball round about your own box too long in case somebody makes a mistake. So we need to try and eradicate that, because it has been noticeable the last couple of games. And even, you know, in the latter stages yesterday, you know, we did look quite panicky and quite dodgy at the back. And, you know, we did look as though we were only one step away from another kind of costly mistake. So hopefully we can eradicate that. I mean, Dundee are a poor, poor side. They are where they are because of that. So you would like to think that we can maybe use it to build the confidence to get rid of the mistakes and to maintain the home form. So I'm still confident of the game on Saturday. I don't foresee Dundee posing us too many problems as long as we are committed to getting the 3 points. The players are still earning a wage. The fans are still paying to get in. We're still, you know, got a chance of finishing seventh. So let's go and try and finish the season strongly, and then we can all take a wee break for it.
And just finally, to wrap things off, we obviously give a lot of attention to the fan issues at the Rangers game, the last home game at Fir Park. There was a wee bit of actual backlash. It kind of came up this week in the podcast Twitter, saying that we hadn't really taken a very rounded view of it. For starters, we didn't know anything about the fact that a steward had been kind of caught up in the Rangers celebrations at one of the goals. We didn't know that there was seats broken. We recorded 3 or 4 hours after the full-time whistle. So perhaps we took a bit of a swing at the perpetrators in the Motherwell end and didn't focus on the bigger picture. But for me, we need to deal with our own issues. To be perfectly honest, we know the issues within the Rangers support without risking the wrath of the Vanguard Bears or any other organisation associated with them. We don't really need that shit, to be perfectly honest with you. But we need to get our own house in order before we start focusing on issues with visiting supporters, of course we do. Now, there's been a lot of interesting debate, and I hope to get Derek Watson on today. That's not happened because, in his own words, he got in at 6 o'clock and he was still pissed. So, we've not been able to get a more informed debate on this, given Derek obviously is heavily involved with a lot of the good things that the Motherwell support do. We said at the time, though, that the boys, they've contributed so much to the club, that can't be taken away from them. But there will be idiot elements and actions of a few that can waste it for the majority. And that certainly was the case at the Rangers game. Obviously, in the aftermath, Alan Burrows has banned one individual from Fir Park. They're looking into a few other incidents. I believe as well that there was a few incidents that were dealt with behind the scenes. And fair play to the club for acting so swiftly on that. Now, we've got the likes of Tom English and a few other bloody Graham Spears and telling us what it's like to be a football fan. Now, I would actually challenge the likes of Graham Spears and Tom English to come to a football match, come to an away game and travel by train and experience what it is to be a football supporter. Who is Tom English to tell me what it's like to be a football fan and how football fans are? Because I don't believe they've ever actually experienced it for themselves. I don't believe the hypocrisy when it comes to policing football fans has ever been dealt with by Tom English when he goes to sit in the press box and is given his free pie at half time. It's bullshit. And that's mm-hmm. a major, major issue for me in terms of the way that incidents with football fans is reported. And you look at Kelvin Grove Park on the first sunny day of 2019, you've got the bloody horses in and everything else because people can't behave themselves. So you're telling me that in crowds quite often of 50,000 plus supporters, you get two or three arrests. That's as big a deal as 200 or 300 people and there's 60 or 70 arrests at Kelvin Grove or whatever it was. It's just bonkers the way this is reported, and I'm really getting pissed off the whole kind of preaching from the mainstream media who don't experience what it's like to be a football fan. They don't experience the knock-on effect that if you've got 8 or 9 transport police preventing people from having a car train to a football match, they don't have to be boisterous, they just have to be a football supporter. And that is, it's a major, major headache just now, and continuous flawed reporting and false reporting is going to be a danger. But by that token, we do need to deal with the issues, and the maybe weed out the rats was a wee bit kind of brought on by the lager I had consumed earlier on in the day. But we do need to get our own house in order. And then does that bring us on to the safe pyro, the safe standing and everything else? Do we need to be a wee bit more careful with our timing here? I would say so.
No, I think you're right. I mean, the media thing is a very valid point. You know, it is obviously the media's job to report on things. It is nowadays, unfortunately, the media's job to sensationalise things, because it's no longer just about, you know, providing you with the news and opinion. It's about battling for readership numbers. It's for battling for, you know, clicks on Twitter and Facebook. So it's far more an entertainment industry than it is necessarily a news industry. But there are, you know, journalists who, you know, almost seem to revel in that kind of thing. You know, and it's kind of stoking this kind of three-pronged attack, if you like, on football from politicians, from the police, and from the media, as we kind of discussed, you know, on the last podcast when we were talking about it. And the media are kind of stoking the flames. You know, we've all been at festivals or gigs that, you know, there's you know, similar behaviour, if you like, to football. We've all seen videos on Twitter of, you know, folk being the biggest assholes ever at horse racing, for example. We all know, like, that Hampden has turned into hell on earth when Take That are playing, because, you know, there's all these pished up women walking about, you know, fighting with each other and you know, pissing in the street and things like that. And it almost, yes, it makes the news, but it's almost like oh, look, this was a shambles, you know, thank God this doesn't happen regularly. And nobody joins the dots. Nobody realises that there is, you know, poor behaviour in all walks of life. It's just football's a very easy, easy target. It's the same with the whole sectarianism debate. Yes, sectarianism is rife at a particular, you know, particular clubs within Scottish football, but it's a societal problem that has manifested itself in football. And yet, if you were an alien and you arrived on planet Earth and, you know, you came to Scotland, if you read the papers or listened to politicians or spoke to the police, you would be fully under the impression that sectarianism exists purely within football rather than on the street. So there is this weird, weird sort of culture within the press that when something goes wrong at the football, it is, you know, the worst thing in the world and it deserves to be splashed all over the papers. But if it happens at a gig or the horse racing, you know, or the rugby or any other sport that's maybe slightly more upper class than football, then it's just, you know, boys will be boys, or, you know, women haven't had too much to drink, that kind of thing. It's unfortunate, but it's also, as you said, you know, I think you need to play the game a wee bit. When that is the situation, then you perhaps do have to be whiter than white for a spell, to kind of, you know, get past that before you can then start talking about the likes of Safe Pyro and stuff like that. I mean, I thought it was quite interesting that you know, it was actually Derek Watson that pointed it out to me, the fact that the video that the club brought out, a very, very good video that they brought out, for the season tickets, actually has pyro in it. I mean, you know, there's, you know, a flare or a smoke bomb or whatever it is in the Motherwell support in one of the shots they use, which I thought was quite interesting. And we see fantastic displays all over the world. You know, really, really impressive things that do contribute to the whole atmosphere and the whole spectacle that is football. So we could hopefully get to a point in the future where things like that are allowed. But I think to get there, it's almost, you know, a case of having to be whiter than white, because for as long as, I think that's why we were so you know, frustrated after the Rangers game, because this kind of war on football is so obvious, you kind of need to rein it in a wee bit more rather than feeding it. I know that obviously it's almost natural to kind of be like, well, if they're going to, you know, write those things and they're going to be heavy-handed and they're going to bring in more laws, then fuck it, I might as well do what I want anyway. That's almost a kind of a, you know, a natural rebellious attitude to have, particularly if you're perhaps of the younger generation. But I do think we're at a situation where if folk genuinely want anything good to come in terms of, you know, being allowed, whether it is, you know, your Safe Pyro or being given a wee bit more leeway in terms of what you're doing at the football, there is going to have to be a spell of, you know, trying to be a bit whiter than white, dealing with the culprits, you know, perhaps quite heavy-handedly, just to try and get past this, what is, to me, a war on football. Football has become the scapegoat for society's ills. Football fans have become, you know, some of the worst criminals about. You're automatically perceived as, you know, a second-class citizen because you're going to the football. And yet, if you're going to the, you know, Cheltenham, or you're going to, you know, Hamilton Races, or the Take That gig, you can basically do what the hell you want, and you know, nobody really bats an eye.
Yeah, and I think that's the hypocrisy in it all, isn't it? I think it was the British Transport Police put out a kind of thing about the rugby and talking about, oh, they'll be boisterous, there'll be a laugh, they'll sing songs and everything else. Try singing a song in a fucking ScotRail train as a football fan. See how that goes for you? Because generally football fans are absolute targets just now. And that's why I was a wee bit disappointed that we kind of slipped into that at the Rangers game, and especially on a scale, and maybe that sounds a bit strange, doesn't it? But it's a televised game. If you're going to misbehave, don't do it in a televised game. That's not what I mean. What I mean is, when you're on that kind of platform and everything else, you've got to be whiter than white, and that then subsequently allows you to look into the things like safe standing, to look into things like safe pyro. And I know from, I don't think it's a hidden fact, that both Alan Burrows and Grant Russell are absolutely for the kind of safe smoke and safe standing and everything else, anything that can give us an advantage on the park. And there's absolutely no doubt that if you've got a kind of boisterous and atmospheric Fir Park, then it does transcend onto the park, and it builds up the players. I'm not saying I never really have subscribed to the 12th man thing and anything else. It's as much a myth as Scott McKenna is, but I think it definitely gives you an advantage if your home ground is a difficult place to visit. Of course it does. So the club want to work with the supporters because it's in their best interest. It's also better to actually sell the place for season tickets and everything else. If you're coming along a stadium that is your home, and it's, you've got this stamp on it. So the club definitely need to be working with the fans and have that understanding. And I think certainly amongst the people at the top, there is that understanding. What we need to avoid doing is crossing that line and making sure that we fight the right battles at the right times. Because I don't think you can start talking about safe pyro and everything else just after your support has been splashed all over the press because you've been throwing lighters at and pies at players. It's kind of knowing when to fight your battles.
That's it. I mean, it's all linked. I mean, that's what I was saying earlier. It is all linked. You know, the police, you know, I've obviously targeted football fans for many, many years, and it's almost, you know, easy targets in terms of numbers and you know, hitting targets and that kind of thing. Politicians are obviously, you know, on the back of the OBFA being repealed, are obviously now weighing up the idea of strict liability and challenging clubs to be seen to do something. So Motherwell were in, you know, regardless of what your opinion is on, you know, an indefinite ban for, you know, chucking a lighter and things like that, Motherwell were in a, you know, a very, very tough position, as you know, Hearts, you know, closing parts of their stand and stuff like that. Clubs, you know, yes, some may perceive clubs as maybe reacting to it recently as being, you know, too heavy-handed or punishing, you know, particularly with Hearts closing stands, you know, maybe punishing, you know, groups of people when it's individual behaviour. But the clubs are in a very, very difficult position at the moment because they are being watched, they are under scrutiny. And when you have, you know, when you factor in the fact that the press are so on side with this kind of scapegoating of football and so on side with this war on football, it means that any incident is going to, you know, be all over the papers. Even you look at the Aberdeen banner, you know, where it was the, I think it was in Spanish, you know, Morelos's Moza mattress or something along the lines of that. And, you know, you could obviously debate all day about the political correctness of that and stuff like that. But that's, you know, a song that's been, you know, sung at Motherwell games, you know, Motherwell Hamilton Accies games in terms of Dougie Imrie. It's a song that I don't think... Yes, some people might go, oh, that's a bit unsavoury or whatever, but it's the kind of banner that maybe a year ago, 2 years ago, nobody would have, you know, bothered with. It would have been this kind of, oh, very good. I think a lot of fans, probably even including Rangers fans, if they admitted it to themselves, would probably have found quite funny and quite witty and quite creative, if you like. And yet, because it's in the midst of this attack on football fans, it just becomes, you know, it was splashed all over the back pages, along with, you know, items getting thrown at football, and it becomes, you know, a stick to beat football fans with. So I think that's a good example of how much kind of the press overplay it. But we are in a situation where the clubs need to be seen to doing something because clubs don't want the likes of strict liability brought in. The clubs don't want you know, the government to be bringing in more legislation that's going to impact on them. And football fans don't want that either. We you know, those of us who, you know, perhaps experienced the OBFA and have, you know, a good in-depth knowledge of it, were, you know, obviously against it because it was so kind of heavy-handed and so just such poor legislation. And if you that's managed to be repealed, the only way you then, you know, make sure that it continues to be repealed and isn't replaced with something isn't to start chucking lighters and coconuts. You know, it's to try and go, right, okay, look, we'll go to the game and we will, you know, be boisterous and we will sing and we will chant. And if I want to have, you know, if I want to have a beer on the train, then, you know, I will maybe do that. But, you know, there is obviously a line. There is, of course, a line, you know, that you can't just go, oh, well, you know, creating an atmosphere so it's all right to chuck things. So, you know, there is a line that we still need to adhere to. You know, I've been very vocal in terms of the OBFA and stuff like that for many years now. And, you know, I do think we're actually reaching the point, and I made the point on Twitter, I think we're reaching the point where the phrase football fans' rights, you know, is a phrase that's actually going to have to start being used. It's the kind of phrase that I think non-football fans and the wider public and the press would probably tear to shreds. But we're actually getting to that point. You know, football fans' rights are being overlooked. We are being treated like second-class citizens a lot of the time, sort of, you know, potential criminals before even doing anything, not afforded the same liberties as other, you know, people in society that are going to other events. But by the same token, you don't battle back against that by simply ignoring things that go wrong. And I think that's why we were so frustrated when talking about that Rangers game. I wasn't aware that the Rangers fans had done anything. Not surprised, of course, but we are aware of what, you know, the fans of that club will do. And I think it's up to individual clubs to call out their own fans and to try and self-police and to try and obviously, you know, even educate these people, you know, if you've got a 15-year-old kid is now banned from Firth Park for X amount of time, it's important that he comes back after that and realises why he was banned. And, you know, it's not just, oh, throwing things is wrong. It's throwing things on the park could possibly get Motherwell fined. It could, you know, if strict liability comes in, we could be fined, you know, a sizeable sum that perhaps, you know, when you're watching transfer deadline day down in England, when billions of pounds are getting thrown about, maybe, you know, 30 grand doesn't seem much, but it's a lot to a club like Motherwell. That could be, you know, a player's, you know, a young player's wage for the year. You know, so I think we need to start trying to educate a wee bit more. It's not just about going, you've done something wrong, so you're banned. And then once you've served your ban, you can come back in. There needs to be communication between the club and the fans to say it's not just that throwing things is wrong. It has a genuinely serious impact on the club. And at the end of the day, if we're all Motherwell fans and we all want the best for the club, then we should be going out our way to make sure that things that harm the club just don't happen. And we should be calling them out when they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, yet again, you've managed to talk for about 5 minutes at the end there and make a fantastic point that hopefully will resonate with some. And I think there's a big issue with, for me personally, I just feel that this hasn't been a kind of holier than thou type thing and everything else. I believe that I want to be able to continue standing in that section of the ground, being part of the atmosphere and everything else. And I feel quite passionately about it. I really feel that it would be a travesty for Park and going back 10, 15 years if we were to lose that section, if for talking sake, if it was to be closed or a point was to be made by closing that section of the ground, it wouldn't make Firth Park a pleasant place to go. It would be back to the days of like Morris Malpass, when you had 9 or 10 people standing in that section and trying to create a din against many other elements. And we don't want to set ourselves back. So I think it is imperative that we actually all do work together to maintain that atmosphere, to continue moving things in the right direction. And at that point, I think that's where the club got on board and they do work with the supporters to try and make it the absolute experience that we know it can be. As I've mentioned many times before, Penny's 7 and she was standing in the back row of that section at the Rangers game. Whether that was bad parenting, I'm not 100% sure, but she likes the noise and she likes the colour of that section. Now, when there's people throwing pies and lighters, it's very, very difficult as a parent to explain what's going on. Mm-hmm. All you can really do is remove her from the situation and think, did I take her back to there? The answer to that in the immediate term is possibly no. You've got to be reassured that that's not going to happen again. So I think it is the duty, perhaps, of the more experienced heads within that group of supporters to ensure that that doesn't happen again and that's not happening on a regular basis, because inevitably it comes back in you. There's guys there that have got well-paid jobs and that are very responsible people, that the last thing they need in a Monday morning is a chap at the door or don raids, as they seem to do with football fans. It must be a very difficult situation, and I would completely understand if a lot of these kind of older heads are just going, you know what, we just remove ourselves completely from the situation. But it would be to the detriment of the atmosphere and the fan experience at Firth Park. I can't overplay enough how much a contribution they make to the fan experience at Firth Park. It's a very difficult situation, and I think that it's one that hopefully can be resolved by working with the club and also being kind of brave enough, I guess, to, if you see someone acting up to that extent, throwing shit on the park and spitting, the spitting thing I really can't get my head around, that has to be dealt with at source. And whether that is stern words or otherwise, we do need to kind of weed that stuff out, and then after that, I think there's a real platform to be worked on there, and you can actually really develop the atmosphere and the fan experience. Because we bypassed the whole SLO thing and everything else, because I think there's kind of well-kent faces amongst their support that people can go to and can talk to. I noticed that even the kind of the drug awareness thing that was ran recently in the spate of the tragic loss of young lives in the local area and everything else, that's pretty groundbreaking for football fans to be that self-aware and to be publicising things like that. The work that the boys do is a testimony to themselves. They really, really do go over and above time and time again. So it's tragic to see things like older heads of the supporters thinking they're not worth the time of day and everything else, and they're more harm and they're more trouble than they're worth, because that's absolutely not the case. They have made Fir Park a far better place to attend. You actually do go back 10 years and think about how poor the atmosphere was. They've absolutely transformed that, and I think that will be something that remains if people don't step out of line. The problem is you suddenly get this reputation for yourselves, and it's very harmful and it's very difficult to eradicate. So it's maybe a bit of a turning point. I do hope that the likes of Derek, and I wish he was here to actually kind of discuss this further, is in communication with the club. They're working at ways around this and ways to solve it, rather than complaining about things like safe standing and safe pyro, because it's just it's a non-starter if you can't actually police the section that you've got. And I do think that there's a case for saying, oh, there's far too many stewards, or there was far too few stewards at the Rangers game. The same people that argue for too much stewards are arguing for too few when something kicks off. So there has to be a balance. There has to be a kind of degree of understanding here. And when we get to that, then I think we've got a very good platform to work from.
No, I think it's spot on. I think it's I think if you actually tie it in with being fan-owned, I mean, I think there is potential, because we're fan-owned, that further down the line, be it, you know, a good few years away, probably at the, you know, looking at the starting point that we're at, but there is genuinely no reason why in a few years' time, if, you know, the Motherwell couldn't be at the forefront of, you know, whether it is, you know, a section that's all safe standing, that has safe pyro, that has all that kind of stuff, that's almost, you know, tailored to allowing the kind of things that perhaps, you know, people kind of shy away from at the moment. You know, as a fan-owned club, that is absolutely the kind of progressive step that we could be leading on. But again, you know, the club's in a situation, as you say, where at the moment you just can't do that. Could you imagine the backlash from the likes of, you know, politicians and the media if we had responded, you know, if we hadn't done anything with the folk that chucked the lighters, but had also started saying that we were going to investigate how we could, you know, allow those guys to you know, be more vocal and do more things down there. It would be completely counterproductive in terms of strict liability and all that kind of stuff. So there just needs to be more awareness. It's not necessarily about punishing people, you know. I mean, you want to lose fans for a start. You know, if someone is banned from Fir Park, it means that you're, you know, you're a body down, for, you know, in terms of attendance, in terms of people being able to add their voice to the songs and the atmosphere and that kind of stuff. So you don't want to be punishing people. It's not about punishment. It's not about, you know, just getting rid of people. It has to be about awareness. It has to be about education. It has to be about saying, look, if you work with, if you're there to create an atmosphere and support the club, supporting the club isn't just about singing songs for 90 minutes. It's about acting in a way and doing things that aren't going to harm the club. And it's about getting that message out, because I think recently, and over maybe the last season or two, there's perhaps, I don't know whether there's been a breakdown in dialogue between the fans and the club. I don't know whether it's just a natural kind of result of a younger generation coming through. But there does seem to be you know, a wee bit of a disconnect there. And it's a, so I suppose it is about, you know, raising awareness and kind of just getting everybody working together. You don't need to like every Motherwell fan. I certainly don't. But there needs to be, you know, this idea that we are a fan-owned club. Whether you sit down with the, you know, that section or not, whether you join in or not, there's still an integral, that part of Fir Park, that part of our support is still a massive, massive thing. You know, you don't get to sit and slate the whole section when you feel like it, but then, you know, be a part of some of the fantastic scenes at semi-finals and finals. You know, it works both ways. They deserve, you know, the folk who go along to create an atmosphere and be colourful deserve support, not just from the club, but from other football fans. But again, that means about being more self-aware and understanding what your actions, you know, do to not just yourself, but to the club. Because let's be honest, because the clubs are under scrutiny at the moment, if at the Dundee game somebody throws something else, what's then going to happen? Are the club just going to ban him, or do they then need to take it a step further? Does that section need to get closed and suddenly nobody can go down there? I mean, that's what we're talking about. We're not just talking about punishing the offenders. You know, there's only so much the club can do, and it's the club's in a very, very difficult position at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's such a issue that I can't really kind of stress how important it is. It's something we will pick up on again in the next coming weeks, particularly when the games aren't of the same magnitude as they are at other points of the season. And hopefully we will get Derek on when he sobers up. And also check out his podcast as well, because it's very good. I think that pretty much covers this for this week, Jay. Thank you very much for your time.
No worries. I think I'll go and sit in the sun.
Well, I've got a women's game. The women's team take on Glasgow City this afternoon. 12 in a row champions, so it wouldn't be a very easy task, it must be said. But it'll be good to see. I think they've got five of the Women's World Cup squad in their ranks as well. So certainly a big step up for them. But it'll be interesting to see the calibre of the likes of them. I think it's only now 2 months away from the first game at the World Cup, the England game. And also there's the Jamaica game at Hampden as well, which is which hopefully a good response. I think the record attendance is only 4,500 at women's international match, so surely they'll surpass that. Although there seems to be I think the USA game, the guy at the SFA was saying that three of the four stands were absolutely packed, but somehow they came up with a figure less than 4,500 at one of the recent games, which they were a wee bit pissed off about, to be perfectly honest. But I don't know whether the turnstiles at St Mirren Park don't work or whatnot. But certainly, they'll surpass that at Hampden. But hopefully, the Motherwell women's team do put in a performance today and compete. I think they've been doing that for the best part of their campaign so far in the top flight. And they're still battling away and still avoiding that bottom spot, which is the most pivotal thing when you do get promotion to the top flight. So good luck to them today. You've been listening to the MFC podcast. We'll be back after the Dundee game on Monday. Until then, thank you and goodbye. Every now and then I cower and I need to find empowerment. Empowerment is paramount to how I can begin to mount a plan that I can implement to make it then on ignorance. Instead of drunk belligerent dissidents and mistress, especially in this instance, with a never ending persistence to use words in excellence as if they were blunt instruments to beat a hole in their defense. There's beauty in their innocence, which serves to build resistance, spite of all my good intent. Beats that my heart skipped. This is the beat that my heart skipped. This is the beat that my heart skipped. This is the beat that my heart skipped when we first met. Now that I've heard it, it leaves with a kind of regret and a disrespect, but we left a lot of people upset. What we had wasn't really what we come to expect. This is the beat that my heart skipped when we first met. That I've heard it, leaves with a kind of regret and a disrespect, but we left a lot of people upset. What we had wasn't really what we come to expect. Well, good goddamn, and
utter such phrases. Haven't heard a beat like this in ages. To miss such a beat would have been outrageous. When your heart skips a beat, it's ruthless and aimless. And then she reeled me in, expecting nothing more than kiss, necks and quick sex. But that weren't the case with this platinum princess. She'd attracted my interest, so I wanted to impress upon her all the positive things that come from having more than just a one night fling. But that's something easier in theory than in practice, cause pick up runs are tactics to get prey to the mattress. And this actress is practicing shining such theatrics, put upon daily by tactless geriatrics. So my genuine advances are met with real scepticism. Throwing compliments, she just straight elects to miss them. Her lips are put on this earth for dispersing wisdom. God forbid I suggest she lets me kiss them, but I really want to know what she thinks of me, cause I'm loving every idiosyncrasy. But I ain't one to jump for hoops to make a first impression. Been there, done that, learned the worst of lessons. Wanna be loving who we appear to be instead of who we are. So our real selves hide behind the pomp and the facade. And that's the truth, the rude boys down in pints and acting hard. As a kid shunning convention with clinical disregard. This is the beat that my heart skips. I don't wait.
Bum, 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 body, bum, body, body, body.
Now that I've heard it, it leaves me with a kind of regret. No disrespect, but we left a lot of people upset. And what we had wasn't really what we come to expect. Beat them and hearts skipped when we first met. Now that I've heard it, it leaves me with a kind of regret. No disrespect, but we left a lot of people upset. This is the beat that my heart skipped when we first met. Now that I've heard it, it leaves me with a kind of regret. No disrespect, but we left a lot of people upset. And what we had wasn't really what we come to expect. Beat them and hearts skipped when we first met. Now that I've heard it, it leaves me with a kind of regret. No disrespect, but we left. What we had wasn't really what we come to expect. Every now and then I cower and I need to find empowerment. Empowerment is paramount, so how can begins, man? Man, I can implement to make it then on ignorance. Instead of dreadful interest, dissidents and mischievous. Especially in this instance, never any persistence. Use always an incident, as if they were blunt instruments. Be a hole in the defense, beauty and her innocence. Surgical resistance, marvel my good intent. Be them a heart skip.